Fate is the Hunter isn't just another aviation memoir. It's a profound meditation on mortality through the eyes of those who tempted it daily. In the golden age of commercial flight, death was not an abstract concept, but a constant companion in the cockpit. Ernest K. Gann transforms technical flying narratives into existential reflections that have captivated readers for over six decades. Jimmy Buffett called it his desert island book, while countless professional pilots consider it required reading. What makes this work so enduring is how it reveals the paper-thin margin between survival and disaster, where 50 feet of altitude or 2 seconds of attention can mean the difference between life and death. These aren't just close calls, they're intimate encounters with mortality that leave an indelible mark on those fortunate enough to survive them. We were aerial untouchables, former mechanics and barnstormers with grease beneath our fingernails, clinging to leather jackets as the last vestiges of our carefree flying past. Unlike military pilots with their prestigious academies, we faced Lester, a crash survivor with a reconstructed face who taught airline standards. His soul-chilling blue eyes announced we'd learned to fly our way, despite our logbook lies. My fellow students formed a colorful tapestry. Handsome Gay from Tennessee, Defiant Sisto, Homesick McGuire the Crop Duster, Tattooed Carter, and Debonair Watkins. Three would be abandoned by fortune, six would experience incredible protection, and even Lester himself would eventually succumb to the dangers he warned us about. Lester's brutal philosophy became our standard. I don't care if you kill yourselves, but the company cares if you kill passengers. This business-like approach challenged those who saw flying as joyous rather than commercial. Yet we remained bewitched by our passion despite financial hardships, practicing in single-engine planes where mistakes bred further mistakes, just as in reality. My third landing attempt was terrible. More an arrival that hit with a soul-shattering thump like a bad accident in a large hotel kitchen. Defeated, I resolved to quit flying. Yet watching planes reminded me of an essential truth. No pilot alive can resist watching aircraft in motion. Captain Ross was magnificent. Tall, dark-complexioned, with searching black eyes and a powerful handshake. His distinctive uniform cap with patent leather bill created his personal style through subtle modifications. Taking off from Syracuse, I anxiously watched for Ross's hand signal to raise the landing gear. When his hand moved slightly, I prematurely yanked up the gear. "Jesus, man!" Ross fought the controls as we hung in the air, sinking, then rising. Through magnificent skill, he salvaged what should have been a disastrous aborted takeoff. I expected fury, but Ross showed none. "If you ever do that again," he said deliberately, "I'll cut you out of my will." I recognized him as a true master, someone who understood teaching required not just technical knowledge, but knowing when mercy outweighed punishment. At 9:26 p.m., at 5,050 feet, I prepared for descent. As I reached for the stabilizer wheel, Beatty made a horrible, sucking sound. In the darkness ahead appeared a hideous apparition, a thickening of night with a green wingtip light and flickering engine exhaust flames. It slid across our vision, missing us by just 50 feet before vanishing. The occupants of the other plane never saw us. The encounter lasted only 2 seconds, but we'd glimpsed what dead men see and survived. When our eyes met, Beatty offered a melancholy smile, the perfect comment on our helplessness. Those sloppy extra 50 feet of altitude we'd maintained earlier had saved our lives. This exemplified aviation's capricious nature, the difference between life and death measured in feet or seconds. Like when I happened to glimpse oil erupting from our engine moments before catastrophic failure, or spotting a hole in clouds during a hydraulic emergency, a hole that closed completely 5 minutes after landing, the only break in cloud cover for 700 miles. Climbing above San Francisco Bay, I watched the night fog glowing amber from city lights, bridge towers jutting like channel buoys in a netherworld sea. Among my instruments, one fuel flow needle flickered slightly. These hypersensitive gauges sometimes cry wolf, especially in the DC-4A with its compromised fuel system. Our crew found that perfect flying angle, on the step, gaining 10 knots of speed, proving we weren't yet mechanical men ruled by instruments. But our satisfaction vanished when engines began backfiring until all four quit simultaneously. The airplane descended toward the Black Sea. In that terrifying silence, fear surged as we banked toward land. The engines restarted, but only at nearly full power, with propellers in full low pitch. Our problem? We could only fly full blast or not at all. Approaching San Francisco, we lowered landing gear despite speed limitations, still moving dangerously at 190 miles per hour. Investigation revealed the DC-4A fuel system couldn't supply enough fuel at altitude, a solution discovered not through engineering theory, but through pilots' life-threatening experiences when engines fell silent. On May 30th, an Eastern Airlines flight plunged into an uncontrollable dive with no survivors. That same day, I flew an identical aircraft from Honolulu to Burbank, experiencing a mysterious vibration that persisted intermittently for 4 hours, despite thorough inspections. After landing, mechanics found only a broken exhaust clamp, seemingly too minor to explain the vibration. Our next leg to Oakland proceeded smoothly, making our earlier concerns seem unfounded. The next morning, I discovered the outboard hinge bolt of the left elevator was missing. A respected test pilot later revealed the truth. The vibration and missing bolt nearly caused catastrophic unporting, an aerodynamic destruction of elevator balance that would have sent us into an unrecoverable vertical dive, exactly what happened to the Eastern Airlines flight. Through sheer luck and unwitting decisions, maintaining high power and keeping the same weight distribution, I had accidentally created the only conditions that prevented disaster. Any different choice would have been fatal. On a night flight from Honolulu, I flew with co-pilot Howe, a legendary aviator with 17,000 hours. Despite his experience, having barnstormed in Jenny's and flown mail with Lindbergh, circumstances had reduced this veteran to serving as my co-pilot. In the moonlight, Howe's face became statue-like, embodying aviation's history, helmet and goggles, fabric-covered wings, and cow pasture landings. Line pilots cultivate a psychopathic modesty, genuine yet humorous. They never boast about perfect landings, but downplay their skills. I barged around. The ship landed itself. Yet beneath this facade, they wear courage like a comfortable belt. After thousands of hours, we'd all seen colleagues vanish. Scroggins and Moore in a thunderstorm, Fay and Sandegren against Bountiful Peak. My logbook showed almost 10,000 hours, representing courage drained and replenished. These numbers declared our luck had been exceedingly good. But luck, like fuel, eventually runs out. For every pilot who ages to tell stories, countless others join that solemn dedication to these old comrades with wings forever folded.